Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. It's clear that the White House has begun to shift its rhetoric on the Middle East. President Joe Biden is now criticizing Israel for its bombing of Gaza. He's called it over the top. And he's trying to take matters into his own hands when it comes to getting humanitarian aid there. Progressive Democrats have gone much further. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called on Thursday for Israel to hold new elections, without which, he said, Israel risked becoming an international pariah. The rhetoric is new, but as we enter a sixth month of the war, what is changing on the ground? Officials have pointed out for a while that Ramadan served as an unofficial deadline for a ceasefire of some sorts, but that deadline has come and gone, and meanwhile, the humanitarian situation in Gaza only gets worse. Aaron David Miller, who's been on this program before and frequently writes for FP, described in the Times this week that if you try to examine what Biden's Middle East policy actually is, it is this: I'm unhappy with Israel, but won't do much about it. In other words, he has leverage to use, but he won't use it. Here's the other issue. Regardless of what you think of the state of the conflict in the Middle East or where you come at it from, public perception of the United States is declining. So whether or not there are costs for Israel, there are costs for Washington, at home and abroad. We often bring on U.S. officials on this program. I wanted to try something different today. Mina Al-Orabi is the editor-in-chief of The National, the UAE's flagship English daily. Mina often gets to speak with diplomats and leaders in the Arab world, and she has her finger on the pulse in a way that is useful for all of us to hear about. Mina is also a columnist for FP. As always, if you like the podcast, rate us, share it with a friend, or try us on video, live, on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That's FPLIVE, one word. Let's dive in. Mina, welcome to FP Live.
Thanks for having me, Ravi.
I know you're fasting, so Ramadan Mubarak as well. Thanks for making time for us. I thought I'd begin with this, Mina. In the United States, we know that the Arab American community is not pleased with the Biden administration's Middle East policy since October 7. But what about perceptions in the Middle East itself? So how do people there think about America's role, specifically on the Israel-Palestine issue?
On Palestine-Israel, there's outrage when it comes to America's policy over the past 5 months or so. There's outrage because, one, the United States has incredible leverage, more than any other country when it comes to Israel. Of course, in the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack on Israel, there was no surprise that there was a lot of American support for Israel. There was a real sense that they had to be close to Israel. But there was also a disappointment from every Arab capital that in none of the public statements, and it seems none of the private meetings, were American officials telling Israeli officials, you have to take into consideration the civilians that are on the ground in Gaza. And then, of course, this develops into the United States' position when it came to using the veto repeatedly to stop the idea of a ceasefire. So I think that if
this
you
is
look
at the United Nations.
At the United Nations. So if you look at how America's foreign policy is viewed at this moment in time, it really is through the prism of what's going on in Palestine, Israel. There are wider concerns, and I'm sure we'll come to it later, ever since, of course, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, concerns of disengagement from Iraq, frankly, a flip-flopping on Yemen and how they perceive the Houthis and so forth. But at this moment, it really is crystallized in the mismanagement, if I'm polite, of America when it comes to the terrible war that we see continuing in Palestine, Israel.
And, you know, you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. If you were to just compare over the last 25 years or so, since 9/11, basically, there have been many low points for the United States in the Middle East. And I'm talking about perception here as well as policy. How do you rank this particular moment, the post-October 7 moment, in terms of how America is perceived in the Middle East?
Its lowest point, I would say. Iraq, absolutely not. I mean, during the lead up to the war, but also after the war and it was handled, there was a lot of criticism of the United States. But I think there was a sense in many of the policy circles that the United States was trying to figure out to do what would be right, but was making mistakes. This time it seems very concerted. It seems that this is being thought through, and the United States believes that this is the best policy, which is to give full support for Israel. You know, at one point you had the president question even the numbers of dead civilians in Palestine, in Gaza. And so I would say it's different this time. It's lower because it doesn't even seem that the United States is trying to do what's right.
Wow. And you're Iraqi, coming from you, that says a lot. I have a question from one of our subscribers, Rhett, and he asks, does the UAE see the damage to America's reputation in the Middle East as a good thing, a bad thing, or a combination of both? And the reason why I put this to you is I kind of want to make it broader, not just about the UAE, but more broadly, do countries in the Middle East, if they're seeing America's reputation take a hit in these last few months, how are they viewing that? Are they going to take advantage of that, or do they see that as fundamentally not a good thing for the global order?
I mean, the Middle East is very divided, to be frank. So you have the countries that are stable, that believe in the nation state. Of course, the Gulf countries, Egypt, Jordan, they are historically allies of the United States. They see this as a bad thing. The United States, for all its faults, remains the strongest ally, and also is seen as really the leader of the world order as we know it, that seems to be crumbling. For those countries that are very critical of the United States, and again, we're talking about the Middle East and so not just the Arab world, then you've got everything from Iran through to Syria and others. They're delighted. And frankly, it is, you know, feeding into the narrative of the so-called resistance front that would like very much to show the United States in a bad light. So I would say, starting from the UAE, where I'm based, and other countries that want to see stability and, you know, international order, they're concerned by the American behavior, but also the perception of the United States as being actually a bad actor. I've heard repeatedly people saying, this is Joe Biden's war. And this war, as tragic as it is in Palestine, with, again, the numbers are horrific, over 30,000 killed, beyond the tragedy, and of course, the suffering that is happening in Israel, particularly for the families and the loved ones of the hostages, it's gone beyond that, of course. We've got the Red Sea, we've got Lebanon, we've got a strike on Jordan that came out of Iraq earlier this year. So this war is no longer just confined to Israel and Palestine, and it's seen as Joe Biden's war.
So, you know, I mentioned at the start that Biden's rhetoric has shifted in the last few weeks. One persistent critique of him, you know, however you see the shift in rhetoric, is that while he's uncomfortable with how Israel is waging this war and the loss of life of innocent civilians, he hasn't actually been able to exert leverage on its leaders to do much differently.
I mean, rhetoric is just rhetoric. And frankly, after what? After he questioned how many Palestinians have been killed, after American officials refused to call for a ceasefire repeatedly, it was incredible. Speaking to diplomats, there's not been any conflict in the last 25 years when I've been working that you haven't at least had, if we talk about rhetoric, a call for a ceasefire, end the hostilities, stop the killing, and then let's figure this out. The fact that the United States was actively working against that has been shocking. And so, yes, I think in the last few weeks, partly pressure domestically, partly because Israel has really crossed so many boundaries, including, as you rightly said in the introduction, there had been hope that by Ramadan, there could be a ceasefire, at least the letting up of the type of strikes that are happening. You know, for quite some time, you're hearing from American officials, this will go into another phase. There'll be targeted strikes. We haven't seen that yet. So I think the rhetoric has changed because of that. But you say he hasn't been able to exert leverage. I think he hasn't wanted to. America continues to have the greatest leverage that any country has over Israel. And again, from diplomats to ordinary people, everybody notes that the United States hasn't been willing to use that leverage.
So, you know, Mina, you and I are both journalists, and we end up speaking to a lot of diplomats, a lot of people in the White House and in other administrations around the world. Let's open our notebooks just a teeny bit here. I mean, what I hear a fair bit from people I speak to in the Biden White House is that President Biden is just not there yet. So even when presented with how his sort of relatively blind support of Israel is hurting him in the polls in the United States, is hurting perceptions of the United States in the Middle East, and in general is backfiring, he's just not there yet in terms of the fact that he has this deep affinity for Israel, and it would hurt him to be seen as anything but that. What are you hearing, and how are you sort of piecing together, you know, where Biden's at and his evolution on this topic?
You're right, Ravi. I mean, we have the good fortune, the jobs that we have, to speak to people who work across different capitals. And all the American sources that I've spoken to, and especially one particular person who's quite close to the thinking in the White House, says to me that Biden would personally be insulted if he was seen as being in any way critical or against Israel. I would say that this ownership of Biden personally for this particular file really reflects badly on him, but is seen as wider, as America. But yes, for sure, this is seen as Joe Biden personally, from the diplomats I speak to, the sources I speak to, Joe Biden personally is taking this position. It's again, it's public how many diplomats within the State Department have been writing cables of dissent. There are, again, diplomats who are working in different embassies who speak publicly of the fact that they don't think this is the right policy. And I will say, many American officials and diplomats worry that this policy is actually going to hurt Israel, in addition to hurting America and, of course, hurting the Palestinians in the wider region.
And what's striking about what you're describing is there's this public sense, not only of what American policy is, but the divisions within the administration, which all seem now at this point clearly telegraphed, and in many ways then placing the blame where it lies. I think the phrase you used was, this is Joe Biden's war. How do you think that ends up hurting him? Again, I mean, in the polls, I know you're not a journalist based in the United States, but in the Middle East.
Look, I mean, for the United States, I worked there for 3 years during the Obama administration. So it's always interesting to see how these things do play out. And for the first time, you actually see domestically, this is becoming a serious issue and how long it will be. For the Middle East, there is a sense, I have to say, there is a sense for people who follow the nuances of these things, still a respect for the American system that allows for diplomats to send cables of dissent, for a push from within against this. But the idea is that ultimately, not only is Biden pursuing this policy, but you've also got Senator Blinken, the Secretary of State, when he went to Israel in the immediate aftermath of the attack, stood at the podium and said, I am here as a Jew. And that surprised people, because of course there are people from all different religions and backgrounds that work and serve in office in the United States. And so to bring up the religion was somewhat surprising. And now we hear the same, of course, with St. Patrick's Day, people talking about, you know, Irish Americans quite concerned with Biden's position, because again, Ireland's position and most Irish people have been very supportive of Palestine and concerned about the level of humanitarian suffering. And so, again, these differences come up, which is a very quintessential American approach to having these hyphenated identities. But there is a sense that, again, the very top people in office in White House and Washington support America, Israel's policies.
And, you know, one of the things when I've pushed U.S. officials on elements of their policy, one of the sort of the frequent sort of pushbacks tends to be, you know, as follows. There is a real rise of anti-Semitism, which is real in the United States and around the world. There is the fact that Israel has few real friends in the region, that it is up against a group that, you know, essentially says it wants to eliminate it. And that, you know, unless it changes something. So, you know, the point that Biden surrogates often make is that October 7 so shook to the core Israel's sense of security, Israel's sense of being, its sense of its right to exist, that that sort of core shaking of that sense has, you know, pushed it to take steps that it wouldn't have otherwise taken. And that the reason why they say all of this is to say we all need to be much, much more empathetic of their position. That's what they say. But how does that sort of push back? How is that received in the Arab world by Arab leaders?
I don't think anyone underestimates the level of trauma, shock, pain that Israel feels after the October 7th attack. And again, you know, in week one, week two, everyone expected that the response would be absolutely brutal. And there's a lot to be said again about Hamas's decision to take this attack and what they were expecting and what they were expecting from their allies. So yes, we don't take that out of context. However, every line has been crossed. The attacks on hospitals, the attacks on UNRWA facilities, the attacks on UNRWA itself, the famine and starvation, the threat of famine and the starvation that Palestinians are going through now, make it very hard to put that context of October 7th out there, because the reality is it doesn't have to be this harsh. One of the things that Israel was, you know, known for, so to speak, was that it had very strong intelligence and a very strong military, and that its intelligence clearly failed to pick up the signs of how brutal October 7th attack would be and the reaction on the day. But also now long term, you know, again, going into the 6 month of war, we've seen the level of devastation. But actually, how much of Israel's so-called objective of eliminating Hamas has been met. For all those reasons, there is a sense that as traumatic as this is for Israel, then Israel should be thinking much more strategically. And if Israel can't think strategically because of the shock and the frustration, although nation states can't act like that, but let's say that's where they're at, then surely it is the country that claims and is the closest ally to Israel should then step in and say, as your friend, as your ally, we need to help you navigate through this period to not destroy what little alliances you do have in the region, but also will be held accountable. And we're seeing what's happening in the International Court of Justice. We're seeing conversations, we're seeing speeches that you would have never imagined even 6 months ago.
What about the fact that, you know, Hamas obviously continues to say that it wants to, you know, eliminate Jews, it wants to, you know, end the state of Israel. It's not backing down from that position. What is the sense in the across the Arab world among, you know, leaders, among policymakers there? How do you deal with a group like that?
Hamas is seen as problematic and probably from Arab countries more than Israel. You know, I'm sure, Ravi, you are across all the reporting that has happened of how Israel supported Hamas. The vast majority of Arab leaders don't want to see Hamas, and frankly, vast majority of people would not want to be living under the rule of Hamas. Problem is, that is a very difficult conversation to have at the moment when the Palestinians are under such attack. It is very hard to say, okay, well, listen, you know, Hamas has to take a position. And of course, no one can accept not only the rhetoric, but much of the actions of Hamas. But at the end of the day, the occupation continues. At the end of the day, they were enabled at a time when the Palestinian Authority was systematically eroded by actions that Israel took. And it's, you know, much more than we have time to discuss in this particular session, but I'm sure many of your subscribers are knowledgeable and know what I'm referring to. So it doesn't in any way justify what Hamas is saying or doing, but at the end of the day, you can't hold Hamas to the same level as you would expect from Israel, that is considered among the nation states and has the full support of America and what it's doing today.
I'm curious what you think about the way in which Arab leaders, not just post October 7, but before that, have been thinking about Israel, because obviously there's been a spate of normalization agreements and movements towards normalization in Saudi Arabia's case. And I've often wondered if there's a growing dichotomy between Arab leadership and the Arab main street. So in other words, as leaders in Saudi and elsewhere have talked about normalizing ties with Israel, the public mood in those places is quite different. But post October 7, how has that dichotomy, as I see it, you might disagree, how has that changed?
Ravi, I have seen officials from across the Arab world. I've been traveling quite a bit in the past few weeks, and I can tell you the level of anger and frustration and disappointment in what Israel is doing and how it's conducting this war is higher than I've ever seen. There are, as I said, there are many, many concerns about Hamas. Most of the officials in key capitals of this part of the world really have problems with Hamas, don't agree with Hamas, would like to see them really, if not, you know, I don't think the word eliminated is right, but would prefer that they were nowhere close to being in power. However, you know, and on the street, for sure, people care deeply about Palestine. I think there came a time, particularly in September of last year, where diplomats and officials abroad wanted to convince themselves that nobody cared anymore. And of course, in a way, this comes after all the fallout from not the, only the Iraq war, but the Arab uprisings. You know, we have broken countries from Syria through to Libya, through to Yemen. Of course, now we see what's happening in Sudan. So, you know, Arab nations have many of their own problems and suffering in addition to what's happening in Palestine. So it kind of went on the back burner, but they never stopped caring about it. For Arab leaders, there's a real sense that we needed a reconfiguration in the region. How do you look to the future? Israel is here to stay. That is the reality that most officials will accept and say, okay, ever since the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, again, we're talking 22 years old, there was an acceptance that Israel is here in the region. We need to find a way to work with it. Some countries, like, of course, the United Arab Emirates and Morocco and others that followed after Jordan and Egypt said, OK, well, we need a peace deal because we need to establish ties. You know, the UAE as a country was established after Israel came into existence. And so there was a sense of let's look to the forward, let's work together. And that, I think, is a completely different narrative than what we're seeing now. And now there's a real sense that you have to find a solution for the Palestinians. There has to be a two-state solution. We can't sidestep the issue because the issue remains core. And again, we're seeing how it's touching so many other Arab countries. And I think the general sentiment amongst officials and people is much closer today than it was 6 months ago. There is a real sense of grieving for the Palestinians.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That is FPLIVE, one word, for the discount.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
We often talk about leverage in these kinds of discussions, and we most frequently discuss America's leverage in terms of how it can shift the discussion, pressure Israel to get to the table. Leverage can be applied elsewhere in terms of Hamas and in terms of the Palestinian people and who represents them. What is your sense of the leverage that the Arab world has in this conflict, in trying to push not only towards a ceasefire in the here and now, but towards a longer term solution?
So look, longer term solution is one that's being discussed by the Americans, by the Europeans, of course, by the Arab countries. You have the, you know, Arab quintet, the countries of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Qatar, and of course, the Palestinians working together on, you know, what does that look like? You've also got efforts by the United Arab Emirates to try to, you know, look at what the future looks like and so forth. But every Arab official I've spoken to said, we need a ceasefire first. The Americans are keen to focus on what the day after looks like. You know, you hear often from American officials, we can't call for a ceasefire and Hamas stays in power in Gaza. No one's in power in Gaza. You know, I don't know how they think a better solution is that you have complete chaos and anarchy in Gaza. And that's what the direction we're going to. Alternatively, Israel remains as an occupying power inside of Gaza. I mean, it was controlling its borders, land and sea, but it wasn't on the ground. Now we're seeing Israel on the ground. So I would say that for the day after, yes, Arab officials are working on it. You know, you've again, you've had the five Arab foreign ministers go to the P5 countries to look at what the day after looks like. There's lots of talk about how do you form the PLO and so forth. But that can't be an excuse not to have a ceasefire, not to end the war. And I think that's a position, again, of all the Arab capitals. No one is saying, let this continue until we figure out what the political sentiment, what the political setup will be like. There needs to be a political reckoning in Israel and what the future of that government looks like. There needs to be a reckoning in Palestine and what that leadership looks like. And that moment is upon us. You know, I don't think we can wait any longer until that political agreement is reached, but it seems like it's going to take quite some time.
Oh, the moment was upon us a while ago. When it comes to the ceasefire, there's been a lot of finger pointing in terms of, you know, why it's been so hard to push for a real ceasefire. What's your sense of, you know, where the culpability lies? Where, you know, why has this kept failing? And how does one change that?
You know, in some ways, it will be when documents are declassified and historians really delve into it, we'll get to see all the intricacies of it. But from where we stand now, and again, from seeing the public positions of different countries, then again, the United States bears a lot of responsibility for not calling for that immediate ceasefire. Germany supported it, absolutely, and the UK supported it, absolutely. But frankly, the UK and Germany, although the UK has the veto power at the UN Security Council, they're the lesser players. It is the United States. So I think they hold a responsibility. Absolutely, Hamas and Israel both, you know, have at different points rejected negotiations. The Qataris have been working endlessly to try to get some sort of agreement, along with the Egyptians, who have played also a very important role in negotiations. But when there isn't pressure from the outside, the warring parties will continue to push. And frankly, you know, again, as everyone is aware, from one side, Hamas will continue to fight as long as they can, because they know the day the guns stop, there's going to be an expectation they no longer rule Gaza. And likewise, you have a prime minister sitting in Israel that the minute the war is over also has his own accountability and is highly unlikely to remain in power. And so then you need that outside force that can change the dynamics. And that is ultimately, at the moment, the United States.
I have a subscriber, Alvaro de Soto, who wants us to riff on Qatar's role in the negotiations. Qatar, of course, sees itself as sort of the Switzerland of the Middle East. And of course, it has long sort of provided a venue for top Hamas officials and also Taliban officials in the past to live, and therefore to, you know, open a channel of communication to them. What is your sense of Qatar's role and how it's shifted over the last 6 months or so? From conversations I've had with Qatari officials, I sense a lot of frustration.
There is frustration because, again, it's a very, very complex and difficult moment to be in. It's a test of wills from different sides, but particularly between Hamas and Israel, and they're testing each other's wills. But I would say also, I mean, you mentioned that Qatar hosted Hamas leaders and Taliban leaders, both not only with the consent, but at the request of the United States.
That's right.
I think Qatar absolutely enjoys playing this mediation role, is quite good at it, has been able to build different relationships. But also, this is a role that the United States has supported and seen as useful.
And part of Qatar's frustration is that because the United States requested it, and Doha often gets a lot of flack, what part of their frustration has been, well, if it wasn't us, would you rather that Syria was in this position? And would you like to go through someone else to have these conversations? I mean, I want to take a little bit of a step back as we look at all of these conversations and the Middle East post October 7. Last week, Avril Haines, the Director of National Intelligence here in the United States, said that the Gaza conflict will have a generational impact on terrorism. What do you make of that?
I think it's an important statement to make. It is hard to imagine what a young person in Palestine today, mostly men, but some women also, can look to the world and not feel completely abandoned and believe in us who will try to preach about international law and the importance of not using force. One of my concerns is that, again, I mentioned Afghanistan. I think people have moved on way too quickly from the complete collapse of the government of Afghanistan. And then, of course, the takeover of the Taliban, because the message there is the people with the guns kept fighting, and in the end, got back power from the greatest army in the world, right? This is not only the United States, actually an international coalition, but importantly, the strongest army in the world. Then you look to the Houthis, and the Houthis fought this war against their own people domestically. This was a civil war, but also United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
This is in Yemen.
And this is in Yemen, correct? And now, after the United States pulled its support for the effort to try to dislodge the Houthis from Sana'a, now you have the United States and the UK and others join the coalition to start bombing the Houthis. And the Houthis are claiming credibility that they're able to affect international commerce. And then, of course, we go to Hamas, and the narrative is that Hamas was able to deal the largest blow to Israel since its existence and establishment. And so again, Hamas is able to say, well, look what we were able to do that no Arab army was willing to do. So, what is the narrative that if you are a young, frustrated person who feels they have no agency, how do you get agency? At the moment, it feels that you pick up a gun or you join one of these militant groups. And we're seeing that with different militia groups across the region. And again, that's why I raise the issue of the International Court of Justice. If there's a sense of recourse that isn't through the gun, then there's some hope. But at the moment, it's very, very weak.
And in many ways, America is at the center of this. So all these groups you referred to, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, there's also the Islamic Resistance in Iraq. They essentially form, by their own sort of terminology, an axis of resistance that is, variously described as anti-American, anti-imperialist, anti-colonizer, whatever the branding is, but it's a unifying force and it is self-sustaining in a sense, or certainly sustained by continued American involvement in the region.
I don't think it's involvement. I don't think the issue is involvement. It's the type of involvement. I think that the United States takes certain positions, and clearly in the last few months, what we've seen with Israel-Palestine that really is detrimental, not only to Israel, but to those, sorry, not only to America, but to those who are allies of America, or those who say, actually, in a world where there has to be a superpower, I'd rather have America and not any other country. Well, now it's really difficult to make the argument in this part of the world because you're seen as a traitor.
And going back a little bit here, one of the things that happened after 9/11, America invaded Iraq, of course, Afghanistan, botched both in a sense and left. And What much of that has ended up doing is allowing Iran to become stronger, not just in Iraq, but across the region. And Iran, of course, backs this entire axis of resistance. In many ways, if you go back to the response to 9/11, we're still seeing many of the chickens from then coming home to roost now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ravi, there is concern that the support for these militant groups that you mentioned now, continued arming, training, money flows going back and forth, getting stronger and stronger at the expense of the nation state. And Iran benefits without anything happening on its own territory. And before I, you know, what I say gets taken out of context, the last thing I want to see is war or more suffering upon the Iranian people themselves and what they've had to go through. But the issue remains that it's easy for Iran to be comfortable within its own borders and actually project power through these cities and these countries that are truly suffering. And again, you know, Damascus, Beirut, Sana'a, Baghdad, although Baghdad is slowly calming down, but still such heavy prices are paid. And now, of course, we see again with Palestine, you know, the Iranians from afar cheering on what Hamas is doing, supporting Hamas, but then very clearly saying we had no knowledge of the attack of October 7th and it's not on us, you know, hands off, it's not on us. And so, of course, there's this frustration because these Arab populations are taking the brunt and all the pain of these policies that Iran supports. And again, it was the current Biden administration, but before that, the Obama administration that opened up channels with the Iranians. And of course, we've just heard they were in direct talks with the Iranians again to ask them to make sure the Houthis don't attack the United States. So sometimes it feels like the United States rewards bad behavior.
You know, I want to just on that point, read out a question that came in from a subscriber right now. It's Michael Dodd, who says, would you both comment on the possibility that the devastation of Gaza, along with the view of America that has been voiced in this discussion, will that be the punctuation point on the end of the international liberal order? It's a very big question. Mina, quick take from you.
I don't know if this is the final punctuation mark, but it's definitely an important punctuation mark. Yes. I really worry about where we go from here. This is a transitional moment. This is a very, very big moment.
Yeah. And my own take on this is that there have long been critiques of American foreign policy, and we've often heard the words double standards or hypocrisy being used. Part of the problem with America's handling of two big wars on two different continents is that the difference between them, the ability of countries in the global south now to point to double standards is much clearer. So in as much as there are middle powers, other powers that are looking for a weakening of the liberal international order, that are looking for a more multipolar world, they now have part of their case made for them, or at least the case is easier for them to make in public in a way that really resonates. Mina, so, you know, we're journalists, we get to criticize all comers, but one of our subscribers, Joseph Hovsepian, wants to put you on the spot, and he asks, what are your suggestions to solve the conflict in the Middle East?
There can be no other solution but to have two states. You need a Palestinian state that has the rights of a functioning nation state. None of this nonsense of, you know, bring troops from Arab countries to come and rule it. None of this nonsense. They can't have an airport and they can't have borders. It has to be a proper state. And the United States and the rest of the world really have to get serious about this and make it happen. That is the starting point. You know, often people talk about it as being the end point. No, that is the starting point because there is so much else to be done. And again, dealing with these broken states like Syria and Yemen and Libya and Lebanon and so forth, and that's on the people of those countries. But frankly, you can't blame them because everybody else has been involved in their business. So it's easy to say, well, those countries should sort out their own issues. Everybody else has been involved. The starting point has to be Palestine. And then other trips start to fall in place rather than saying that will be the eventuality.
And what about the question of who leads the Palestinian people? I mean, they haven't been well served on that front.
No, they haven't. Look, I think there are lots of incredible and capable Palestinians. Sometimes I get frustrated because people say, well, who? There are some incredible and strong Palestinians that have leadership skills and people respect them. Of course, the name of Marwan Barghouti, who's in the Israeli jail at the moment, often comes up as somebody that is in jail, has suffered what the Palestinians have suffered. He was a believer in the Oslo Accord. So he's from Fatah. He signed up to accepting Israel's existence, which often you don't get among some of the Palestinian leadership. And yet he is, of course, put under terrorism charges in Israel and is in prison. You have names like him, you have others, Salam Fayyad, who's a technocrat who could help with developing that nation state that we talk about. So I don't think it's a problem of who becomes leadership. The problem is how do you get about that mechanism? You currently have a leadership amongst the Palestinian Authority that, of course, is invested in staying in power. And you have a Hamas leadership that has no interest in actually coming to a political solution. So I think, again, there are enough, not only Arab countries, but frankly, European countries that have leverage and have ideas of what to do. But you also have in Israel a government that has cabinet members that refuse the idea of a Palestinian existence. And frankly, Prime Minister of Israel himself has said that he doesn't believe in a two-state solution. He's taken everyone for a ride for years and years and years. So how do we ensure that the next leadership in Israel is actually moving in that direction?
And that is a question that Chuck Schumer has very directly put to the American people and the Israeli people just a couple of hours before this session began. Mina, America's been trying to pivot away from the Middle East for nearly a generation now. Do you think it ever can?
I think the Middle East will remain important not only because of its vast resources, but because of its strategic location, from waterways to tying in Asia through to Europe. I think one of the frustrations for many of us in this part of the world is it's almost like America's burdened by the Middle East. And in reality, America has interests in the Middle East. What often happens is the United States says it doesn't want to be involved, but it's involved enough just to influence, but not fully complete something. From the support to the Syrian opposition that just dra helped drag out the civil war, but never really gave them full support to, come to a resolution, to what we've seen again in Yemen, where it's like this back and forth of what they thought of the Houthis, and now suddenly they've decided they are a foreign, they've designated as a foreign terrorist group after criticizing those in the Arab world that called for that. So I think it is much more not it is much more of a concern. The United States isn't consistent, but also isn't straightforward with its interests in the region. It will continue to have a role here. I worry that its role is really diminished by what's happened in the last few months, unless it proves that it cares for the people of this region, or at the very least, won't work in a way that will bring more suffering and destruction here.
Well, I'm sure key officials in the White House and in the government will be listening to this. Mina Al-Arabi, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective.
Thanks, Robbie.
And that was Mina Al-Arabi, the editor-in-chief of The National, a top UAE English daily. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. Next week, we have Richard Haass, the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to talk about U.S. foreign policy in an election year, what kinds of pressures the campaign trail imposes on policymaking, and how we expect to see that play out in the following months. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, Professor of Law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an everyday ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.